Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. American journalist Roxana Saberi attracted international interest last year when she was imprisoned in Iran on false charges of espionage. She faced a death sentence at one point, ended up with an 8-year prison sentence that was eventually overturned. She has written a book about the experience, Between Two Worlds, My Life and Captivity in Iran. She's with us today. Welcome to the show, Roxana.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Let's hear from that point in time. Let's listen to a segment of a report.
Okay, I'm sorry.
From Weekend Edition Sunday, guest host Lynn Neary.
Roxana Saberi turned 32 today in prison. Saberi, an Iranian-American journalist, was convicted in Iran of spying for the U.S. and sentenced to 8 years in prison. Her attorney filed an appeal yesterday, the same day her father, Reza Saberi, announced that Roxana has started a hunger strike and is determined to stay on it until she is free.
That was from April 26, 2009. Does it seem like a million years away or just yesterday?
Well, so much of it is still very fresh in my mind, although I feel a little bit distant, too, because now I'm in America. It's a different country, and I'm sitting in a, quiet home, and I'm looking outside at the wind blowing through the leaves of trees. So it seems a little bit distant, but at the same time, I think because I still know people who are in prison, and I hear so many reports about other people being imprisoned, that memories remain fresh because I know that what I experience is happening for so many others, and for many of them, they're experiencing much worse than I ever did.
The title of your book, it's Between Two Worlds. Can you tell us about that title and how you came to it?
Yes, I felt like, especially, through the whole 6 years, but especially those 100 days in prison that I was, 6 years that I lived in Iran, that is, but especially 100 days that I was in prison, that I was between two worlds. And these two worlds can be defined in different ways depending on the readers, but it can be between America and Iran, between East and West, between imprisonment and freedom, between doing what you know is right and giving into pressures to doing what you know is wrong. It can have very many different meanings.
When you started out in the first few years you were there, you were a freelance journalist, and then you lost your journalism credentials, your official credentials. So that's when you decided to write the book?
Yes, I saw that I had a lot more time on my hands, and I didn't want to leave the country yet because I'd fallen in love with it. So I decided to start doing some research about Iranian society and looking at different groups in Iranian society, and I conducted many interviews as part of this research, and I was writing the book and almost done writing the book when I was arrested in 2009.
My guest is American journalist Roxana Saberi. She was imprisoned for about 100 days in Iran on false charges of espionage in 2009. She's with us right now, and if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us on allsides@wosu.org. And we have some links as well on the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if you want to check that out. You always knew that living in Iran, the homeland of your father, was a calculated risk, especially given your Iranian heritage, because Iran does not acknowledge dual citizenship.
Yes.
When you're there, you're Iranian, and that's all there is to it,
yes,
to them. So tell me about why you went there in the first place and why you stayed for so long. You said you loved the country, so.
Yes. And actually, when I was arrested, I was getting ready to leave the country to move on to the next chapter of my life. But I moved to Iran in 2003. I wanted to learn more about the Iranian society and culture, and I'd never been to Iran, and I felt like I didn't really know that part of my Iranian identity. My mother is Japanese, and I'd been to Japan, but I'd never been to my father's native land of Iran, and I was born and raised in America. And I also thought it would be a wonderful place to report from because I knew that it would be full of news for years to come. So those were the reasons I went to Iran. And initially I was planning to stay there just for maybe a couple of years. But I did fall in love with the country, as you mentioned, and I got to know many people and I made some good friends, and I felt like there was still so much for me to learn and still so much for me that I to share with other people. And especially that's one reason that I decided to write the book, was so that I could give readers out on the outside of Iran more of a broader perspective and a wider understanding of different groups that live in society, and to see how diverse Iranian society can be, and they can learn about Iranians' lives beyond the headlines.
I felt reading the book that I did get a lot of that from the story that you eventually told about your captivity in Iran.
Thank you. Yeah. I tried to give that perspective outside of prison as well, the different kinds of people that I met.
You were not physically abused while you were in prison, right?
That's correct.
But that's not typical, or is it just kind of depend? We don't really know what's typical.
Physical torture does happen mm-hmm. in Iran, and I mean, it's been happening since the, for many decades, really. But I was not physically tortured myself, but we have heard, especially in the past year and a half or so after Iran's disputed presidential elections of 2009, more and more accounts of physical abuse of prisoners, and also accounts of sexual abuse of both men and women prisoners. And even the Iranian government has acknowledged that three detainees were basically tortured to death. I don't know mm-hmm. if they used the word tortured, but in one of the detention facilities in Iran after the elections. So it does happen there, but not to all prisoners. But what does happen to, I would say, almost all political prisoners would be psychological torture mm-hmm. or this mental pressure and mental abuse. And when I was released from prison, I learned that there's a phrase for it called white torture, which doesn't leave a mark on the body but can devastate the mind and the conscience. And it's a combination of isolation, being cut off from the outside world, not having access to a lawyer, being threatened and intimidated and manipulated, and these methods can, and this treatment can have an effect on people that remains for a long time.
How did it affect you?
Well, it broke me in the beginning when I was first arrested. When I was arrested, none of my neighbors was around, and the building caretaker didn't see me being taken by these foreign intelligence agents from my apartment. I mean, nobody saw me as far as I knew, and I wasn't allowed to tell anyone where I was. I was told to lie, actually, to my boyfriend about where I was, and then later on to lie to my parents about why I had been arrested and where I was and so on. So I was very afraid, because I knew also the history of that prison, that many political prisoners had been held there, that some for years, some had died there. I knew about Zahra Kazemi, the Iranian-Canadian journalist who was detained there in 2003, and a few years later mm-hmm. she had died mysteriously. And at the same time, I was in solitary confinement. I wasn't allowed a lawyer. And these are actually very common techniques used by captors against political prisoners and prisoners of conscience in Iran. And during interrogations, I was blindfolded and questioned by several men, and they were telling me that, they could find my family if I didn't cooperate, even though, my family was in America. They were telling me I could remain in prison for 10 or 20 years until I was an old lady, they said, if I didn't cooperate, or I could get the death penalty. And what they meant by cooperate was, they said I was supposed to say that the book I was writing about Iran was a cover for espionage for the United States. They said it's not possible I could be doing so many interviews just for a book, so I must be a spy for the U.S. And I said, well, you confiscated my computer. You can read the chapters I wrote. I'm not a spy, and it's just a book. I had to interview various people so I could get a wide variety of views in Iran. And they said they didn't believe me, and they said they would only set me free if I made this confession, and then they would forgive me, and if I confessed that I was a spy. So I felt very afraid, and I felt alone and hopeless and helpless. And I think that is one of the effects of this white torture that they inflict upon prisoners. That's what they want prisoners to feel, so that they give in and make false confessions.
Unlike so many of the prisoners in that prison, you had the entire country supporting you while you were in prison, and many important American figures spoke on your behalf. Let's listen to some of that.
We believe there is only one outcome to this matter, and that is for her to be released as soon as possible, to return home to her family in North Dakota.
If you have the head of states of both countries responding to each other, then become the ultimate political playoff and trade-off. And she could become a trophy, a pawn in that game.
That was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the Reverend Jesse Jackson. They were just two of the many people who tried to help you, Roxana. How much did you know about what was going on in the outside world in regards to your imprisonment?
I knew I knew nothing for the first month or so. I thought nobody knows where I am, and actually for several weeks nobody knew where I was. I mean, my parents didn't know, and the outside world didn't know. But during those first several weeks, feeling that nobody knew where mm-hmm. I was one of the reasons I felt so weak and gave in to my captors and made this false confession.
Mm-hmm.
But then feeling guilty about that, I decided to recant the false confession, and even though I still didn't know anybody knew where I was, and so my captor said that we knew from the very beginning it was false. It was very strange to me. But I didn't realize that a few days before I recanted that the Iranian authorities had announced that I was in custody in Iran, in Evin prison, and that they would be releasing me within days. Well, they didn't, and I think it's because I recanted the false confession. But when I found out that the outside world knew where I was, particularly through my parents who came to Iran after I was not released and I was able to see them in prison, I felt much stronger, and I felt that I'm not alone anymore, and I don't have to face my captors and injustice by myself anymore. Mm-hmm. And I realized this is what other prisoners who are wrongly imprisoned for their beliefs or for their actions, how they must feel, that they must feel empowered as well. And this is why it's so important, I believe, for the outside world to call for the release and for the rights of prisoners, no matter where they are in the world when they're wrongly imprisoned.
We're going to take a break. When we return, we'll talk some more with Roxana Saberi, author of Between Two Worlds, My Life and Captivity in Iran. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. 49 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:19 this morning. Cloudy skies today, a chance of rain and a high of 63. Clouds tonight and a low of 42 degrees.
Chase supports the quality programming on WOSU Public Media and is proud to support the Columbus Neighborhoods Project. Watch Columbus Neighborhoods with the Short North, transformed from a rundown, forgotten part of the city into Columbus's center for arts and culture. So take a fresh look at one of Columbus's great neighborhoods, the Short North, re-airing on Thursday, October 14th at 9 p.m. and Friday the 15th at 11 p.m., only on WOSU-TV.
And we want to hear what you think of our radio programming. WOSU is creating an online audience advisory panel. Visit wosu.org/survey to sign up and send us your thoughts. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is American journalist Roxana Saberi. She was imprisoned for 100 days in Iran on false charges of espionage. She is with us now to talk about her new book, Between Two Worlds, My Life and Captivity in Iran. You are welcome to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, if you'd like to give us a call. Let's listen to NPR's Lynn Neary talk with your mother now, Roxana Akiko Saberi, about you going on a hunger strike while in prison.
Let me ask you something about her personality. Is she a very determined person? I mean, she's...
Yes, she is. She knows she's not guilty. She hasn't done anything wrong. She knows that, right. And we know that. So to protest that, she said this is the only way. She'll be true to herself. You have to be honest to yourself and to others. That's her character.
Roxana, how did you decide to do something like a hunger strike?
I have never actually listened to that interview.
Oh.
It's interesting. So
your mother sounds
yeah.
just is very, very, with a, is a person with a lot of fortitude herself.
Yeah. She is, I think, more stubborn than I am. So I decided to go on the hunger strike. Well, first of all, I'd seen some of my, after a while, I was taken out of solitary and put in cells with other women prisoners, and I saw a few of them going on hunger strikes as well to get, little things like a call to their family or a meeting with a lawyer or something that they were had been denied. So I saw from them how it is to go on a hunger strike, although theirs were kind of short for a few days. But I decided to go on a hunger strike after I got the 8-year prison sentence because I realized that, first of all, that the whole experience that I had gone through, the way I was treated was, while it was unjust, there was no doubt about it, and also it was a joke that, you know, my interrogator knew that I was innocent, and yet I was, he said he knew that I was innocent, and after I recanted my false confession, he said, you know, we knew it was false from the beginning, that's what he said, but yet I was sentenced to 8 years in prison, and the trial was a sham. I explain all that, all the details in the book, but... and I also thought that this is the only way to put pressure on my captors from inside prison, because the only thing that I can control from within my cell is, other than my attitude, of course, was my body. And I could use it as a tool to try to pressure the authorities to at least reduce my 8-year sentence, because I knew that my parents would be publicizing or talking about this on the outside, which I think is very important for political prisoners who go on a hunger strike, that outsiders are able to publicize the hunger strike.
How did you fare? You were on the strike for, was it 10 days?
In the end, it was 14 days.
14 days.
Yes.
And it was just water in the end. You had sugar and water at first, but...
Yes, I took out the sugar toward the end.
Two of your former cellmates, Mavash Sabet and
yes.
Fariba Kamalabadi.
Yes.
They were leaders in Iran's Baha'i faith.
Yes.
And they were sentenced in August. And I was wondering if you know anything about them, how they're doing. I know they helped sustain you during your hunger strike.
They did. They were two of my angels in Evan, as I like to call them.
The name of the prison is Evan Prison, right?
Yes, Evan Prison. Isn't considered the most notorious prison in Iran. They were being punished simply for their religious beliefs. The Baha'i faith is thought to be the largest non-Muslim religious minority in Iran, and those two women, along with their 5 male colleagues, were the 7 leaders of the Baha'i faith in Iran. And they had already been there for about a year by the time I met them, and had spent much of their time in solitary confinement, and were facing very severe charges, such as insulting religious sanctities and espionage for Israel, which they denied. And these charges could result in the death penalty. Yet the women were very strong and helped lift the spirits of others, including me. And yes, as you said, in August they were sentenced. They got 20-year sentences, and that was later reduced to 10-year sentences, which is still unjust, and I believe they should be freed immediately along with their colleagues, their male colleagues. And they were transferred to another prison outside of Tehran, which is set to be very unsanitary and it's overcrowded, and there aren't enough bathrooms and so on for the prisoners. But I have a feeling that, you know, their spirits are very strong still, and I know that sometimes they hear news from the outside about the outcry for their release, because there are many people on the outside around the world who are calling for their release. Baha'is and non-Baha'is, and I know that this support helps sustain them.
You mentioned a little while ago the disputed presidential election, and the people pretty much took it to the streets. That was after you were released, after you left Iran. As a journalist, that must have been kind of... Did it kind of get to you that you weren't there to cover that?
Yes.
As a journalist, it would have bothered me.
Yeah, I was thinking, wow, this is it's a historic
bad timing.
Yeah, and I'm not there, and I'd love to be talking to the people and see what they think, but I knew that I couldn't be there mm-hmm. at that time, that it would have not have been a good idea for me to be there at that time.
I was wondering about your folks, particularly your dad, if he was worried about returning there, or was it so high profile at that point that they didn't dare touch him?
Actually, I was worried, too, that he might be in danger if he would come there. Maybe the authorities would pressure him to pressure me further or something like
yeah.
that. And he is an Iranian citizen as well, even though he's an American citizen, too. He still is an Iranian citizen. But when he came to Iran, and I was very surprised that he and my mother came to Iran, he was treated civilly, actually. And I think that the case was very high profile, and that's why he was given some protection like that, and he was in the news every day and so on. So I know that the family members of some other political prisoners, Iranian political prisoners, are sometimes threatened. And actually, my father did get a veiled, threat or warning after he was continuing to speak to the media while he was in Iran. He was doing many interviews with media from all over the world,
mm-hmm.
and this aggravated my captors, and they basically said that if you you shouldn't continue doing these interviews. If you want to interview with anybody, just interview with the state-run media in Iran, which, of course, is censored.
Mm-hmm.
And God forbid that a problem arise for you. You're here as Iranian citizens. So that was kind of a threat that, something could happen if you continue doing this.
But he continued anyway.
He continued, and nothing happened to him, but I'm very glad that he continued, because I think that these calls for my release made by individuals and groups around the world, which I'm so thankful for, helped contribute to my release.
It was interesting during the riots in the streets. They were fueled in part by social media, that people could communicate with each other without having to see each other. It was a interesting phenomenon, and I was wondering what you think the impact of technology might be on Iran in the future, how that could change things up, or will it end ultimately the way it has in the last 20, 30 years?
I think that technology can empower and has empowered many of the Iranian people. Iranian youth especially are increasingly tech-savvy,
mm-hmm.
and that's by using technology, that's how they get information from the outside world and get in touch with one another and also send information to the outside world. As we saw during those protests, the effects of the work of many citizen journalists or ordinary Iranians who went out onto the streets and mm-hmm. filmed with the video cameras off their cell phones what they were seeing, people getting beaten, people getting shot.
Yeah.
The image of Neda Aghasultan, a young woman who was shot to death in the street,
it
went viral on YouTube. And I think it having this power of technology has allowed the people of Iran to show realities that hardliners would rather not be shown around the world. But at the same time, of course, many of these forms of technology have limits, and the Iranian authorities do filter many websites, and they try to jam satellite signals of TV channels coming in from overseas and so on. And also, technology has empowered the authorities as well, because they're more able to monitor their people, the citizens. And actually, one of the journalists who has just recently gotten sentenced to, 3 years in prison, Issa Sahar, his son has filed a complaint in America against the Nokia Siemens company, claiming that this company has helped the Iranian government through its giving it technology to set up spying centers on its citizens, and that's how the government monitored Issa's cell phone. But the company denies any wrongdoing.
When I think back to the revolution in 1979, And what we saw from the only perspective we have were from the gates of the U.S. Embassy and the protesters there. It was so interesting to follow along on Twitter and also be watching the videos and, you know, via Twitter, linking into videos of what was happening beyond the gates that we usually are kept at. It was a very different experience, very emotionally, very different.
It is. And you know, I wasn't watching.
You're
the
just
Revolution
a twinkle.
1979, but I was a little young then. But I can even compare 2003 when I first moved to Iran to 2009 when these demonstrations and so on were happening. Because 2003 there was also a student protest that spread to other groups within society in Tehran and a few of the other cities. And I was covering these demonstrations. And I remember at that time, if the world wanted to know what was happening on the streets of Tehran, they had to rely on professional journalists like, Reuters or BBC or me or so on, who had correspondents in Tehran. But we were very limited in what we could do, and we were also censored in what we could send out. And I remember my tapes were confiscated, my cameras confiscated, and so on. So the images of brutality and violence were very limited, but today it's different. In 2009 it was very different because you can't control all these people with all their cell phones.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way. They try, and they're successful to some extent, but they can't control them all.
You know, there was that impression I had. There was some other impressions that I wanted to talk about from your book. One was just about women's rights. I was surprised that women may be firefighters, they may race cars competitively,
yes.
but the inheritance laws are still very much of a throwback.
Yeah.
And I was wondering what's your impression of how women's rights in Iran have withstood the current regime there?
Well, I think that women have become more and more active in Iranian society, and many of them have, for example, been going to higher education. And, you know, in some ways, almost it's paradoxical that with the mandatory hijab or the Islamic women's covering that women are supposed to wear and they've had to wear since just after the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, some traditional families have allowed their daughters to go to college now or to go to the workplace because they know that their daughters will be covered. So in a way, it's almost helped some women. These women who do go to university, they're exposed to new ideas, and many of them move from the smaller towns to the bigger cities, and this is also a result of urbanization. But I think they get to know more about equal rights for women, and they increase their demands on society and also the regime for equal rights. We do see women in many different areas of work. As you mentioned, they have a firefighting squad, which I believe is still the only women's firefighting squad in the Middle East.
Is there a purpose for that, where they can only go there, that it was established so that they could go certain places?
I think, you know, the idea was so that they could maybe help the women victims of fires and also children.
Okay.
Maybe there would be less of it would be easier for them to interact with these people. But still, they say, you know, if there's a man caught in a fire, they're going to help him as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, they do face many limitations, which I think are both from laws, which are which discriminate against women, and also patriarchal mentality that still does exist among some families in Iran.
You mentioned urbanization, another effect of urbanization has been the pollution, and you refer to the pollution in the book, the smog. It sounds horrible.
Yeah, it is.
It reminds me of China when they talk about China.
And I haven't been to China, but I imagine it's,
you know what I mean. I haven't either, but I just kind of
exactly. Yeah, it's
completely,
you know, it's
unchecked.
Part of life. It's a part of everyday life in Tehran. And it got to the point where I remember after a few years that I was there, they were canceling school because of the smog, and then they realized, well, they can't cancel school forever, so they let kids go to school. And for a while, we weren't, you know, at the gym. The gym was closed because we weren't supposed to be running on the treadmill or so on, or maybe we'd go to the gym and only use weights and not the treadmill.
And that's indoors.
That's indoors, yeah. So it does affect your life, and you see many people with masks outside and so on. But you get used to it because you have to, and
yeah.
At first I would get headaches, but after a while I think my body just acclimatized to it.
You know, and also the underground music movement there, you co-wrote a film.
Yes.
No one knows about Persian Cats. I'd heard of it before. I'd been looking at the trailers before, and I was, you know, really happy to know that I was going to be interviewing you because you were one of the writers on it. It's received great reviews. It got a lot of notice and an award at Cannes in 2009, right?
Yes, that's right. It's about it focuses on a young man and woman who want to put together a band and put on a concert and then go overseas to perform because they face many limitations in Iran. To put on a concert or release an album, you need permission from the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, which usually does not give permission to certain kinds of music, such as rap or rock or mm-hmm. or heavy metal and so on. So it follows these two young people as they try to put together their band, and you see the love of so many young Iranians to perform their music, which is really a peaceful form of expression, freedom of expression, and the limits that they face, and they practice in their basements or the attics, and they risk arrest and so on, but they pursue it because they believe in it, and they take that calculated risk to do it.
How did you write for it? How did it work? It comes across as a documentary.
Yes.
Is it documentary?
It's a documentary film, I would say, because it's based on these two young people who really did plan to go overseas.
Okay.
And now they are overseas. They're in England. And
I was wondering if everyone's safe have been identified on it.
Yes. Some of them have – some others have also gone overseas and received asylum or are just living overseas. I believe the ones in Iran are all right. I don't know. I hear through the film director, Bahman Gobadi. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually in touch with the musicians who are in Iran, but I'm in touch with some of them who are outside Iran.
And the film's available in the United States, right?
Yes, it's available on it's going to be released on DVD in I think March or so, and it's going to be released by IFC as well, I think, video on demand.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, Roxana Saberi, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And if I could just add,
sure.
People want to know how they can help bring attention to human rights violations in Iran, they can just go to my website, which if you could, I don't know if you could put it on your
website. Sure, we'll put it on the link.
Whatever.
Yeah.
It's just RoxanaSaberi.com, and there is a page there for human rights.
Okay, we'll put that on our website, WOSU.org. Again, Roxana, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
That's all the time we have for this. When we return, we will be talking with the national president of the League of Women Voters, Elizabeth McNamara. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Developed by WOSU Public Media and the Columbus Metropolitan Library, ColumbusNeighborhoods.org features over 30 neighborhoods in and around Columbus and allows users to tell their own stories, post their own photos and video, and contribute to the collective story of Columbus. To be a part of this multimedia public engagement project or to learn more, visit ColumbusNeighborhoods.org.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. And in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about programs to provide homeless veterans with housing and employment in Central Ohio. That discussion begins at 11, right here on WOSU.
Support for WOSU comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, featuring the U.S. premiere of the latest work by Belgian company Les Ballets C'est de la Baie, Out of Context for Pina, Friday, October 8th in Ohio State's Thurber Theater. Details at wexarts.org.
50 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40 this morning. Clouds today, there is a chance of rain off and on throughout the day, a high of 63 degrees. Clouds and a slight chance of rain tonight, a low of 42 degrees. And then a nicer day for Wednesday, some sunshine and a high of 68. And even nicer for Thursday, sunny skies and a high of 71. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
¶¶
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I want to let my guests, my listeners know that Roxana Sabari, the my last guest, she is going to be speaking about Courage Under Fire, Matters of Conscience and Faith in Iran at 7:30 p.m. tomorrow. I'm sorry, October 13th in Dayton. So we'll put a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. We'll link you to that and her website. Joining me now is Elizabeth McNamara. She is the national president of the League of Women Voters in the United States. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, a lot of folks think of the League of Women Voters as it is, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, just get kind of a get-out-the-vote in general, voter education, educating people about how to vote and where to vote and how to learn more about who to vote for. But you also get involved in specific issues as well.
We certainly, yeah, we absolutely do, including very prominently issues around elections, around barriers to people getting out to vote. But we've also been involved over the last couple of years with lobbying for health care reform and for climate change legislation.
Why do they fit into the matrix of what you do?
You know, the League has a 90-year history of doing two things. One, preparing newly eligible citizens or newly eligible voters and voters that have been voting for a long time to get to the polls, to keep up with the election laws, reducing the barriers to voting that can sometimes be erected in state law and through just course of habit. But we've also have a tradition of being involved in issues that, you know, improve society, make it easier for people to participate. You know, if you don't have health care, that can be a real stress in your life. If climate change has been something that has been extremely important to our members because it is such an important societal issue. So we do both things. We don't go away between elections.
Health care, I suppose, for a lot of people, if you're not feeling well, your health is first on your mind, and
that's
it's hard to
exactly
remember
right
to worry about voting. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, most recently we have been, and over the summer we have been we've been working very, very hard on the Disclose Act.
Right.
The League has a long tradition of wanting to, you know, to maximize citizens' participation and reduce the effects of special interest in elections. We have lobbied heavily in favor of campaign finance reform in all of its iterations over the last 50 years. And most recently, after the Citizens United decision, well, we've been in a position where the only real recourse we have is to urge disclosure of the money, of the secret money that is coming into politics to try and get rid of the foreign money in politics.
Let's remind people what the Citizens United decision is. That was a U.S. Supreme Court decision.
It was. Mm-hmm. Citizens United, overturn, you know, 100 years of campaign finance reform in this country, and court cases in support of that, and found that special interests could spend money out of their general funds in unlimited quantities to support issues or to electioneer in our elections. The Supreme Court did not specifically address the issue of foreign corporations putting money into our elections. Mm-hmm. Foreign citizens are not allowed to do that. The Supreme Court found that corporations have some of the same rights as citizens, but did not specifically address that particular aspect. Nor did the court decision have anything to do with was there any issue involving corporations that had taken government bailout money. And the Disclose Act that has been passed by the House would address all of those various issues. Special interests, not just corporations, but any special interest would have to disclose the source of its funding if it was going to engage in election politics. Foreign controlled corporations would be prohibited from participating, and corporations that took government bailout money would also be similarly restricted.
And there's something requires CEOs to stand by their ads.
That's exactly right.
What's the implications of that?
Well, the implication is that they're going to have to put their mouths where their money is, rather than having this, you know, this what we're seeing so far is that the rate of disclosure in this country has dropped, in this election has dropped by half. I believe the last reports I saw that only 32% of the ads running or the money that is being donated is being formally attributed to any particular donor. And the Disclose Act would require that a company CEO or the president of a union or the president of a nonprofit would have to stand behind any issue advertising, just like a candidate does.
614-292-8513 if you would like to speak to Elizabeth McNamara. She's my guest right now. She is the president of the League of Women Voters of the United States. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. In a press release, you said that it's critically important for the disclose legislation to be passed this year. Why this year? Is that a timing thing, or are you worried about a changeover in Congress, or what?
Well, we very much want this to pass as soon as possible. We have been working on this since the inception, since it was passed in the House over the summer. We were working very, very hard to try and get it through the Senate before, so that it would, you know, be in effect for this election. If it were to pass, you know, any time that it passed, it would be all right with us if it passes this year. But it's at this point probably a little bit too late for this to have any impact on this particular election. We are still very hopeful that we can get this passed before the end of the year. If that doesn't happen, we're going to keep working on it.
Can you give us some examples of instances during this election cycle when there hasn't been adequate public disclosure to campaign finance records?
From everything that I've been observing, I think just as we've all been observing, you know, this election cycle, as with many others, we're seeing more and more of the nonprofit groups that are, you know, with lovely sounding names, supporting particular candidates or advocating for particular issues. And it's from everything that I have been reading, everything that I have been seeing, it is getting harder and harder and harder, even for journalists and for good government groups to try and ferret out where this money is actually coming from.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to speak to Elizabeth McNamara. She is president of the League of Women Voters of the United States. She is my guest. She is going to be in Columbus tomorrow. You're here to observe a debate for the Ohio Supreme Court?
Yes, I certainly am. And I've been speaking to election officials and talking about, you know, preparedness for this election and getting an idea of what efforts are being made to make sure that voters have the necessary tools when they go to the polls. And certainly the League works very, very hard to make sure that voters have that information. Our premier website is vote411.org. It is one-stop shopping for your state election information, links to the Secretary of State's office, and also for nonpartisan candidate information.
You know, I was listening to a story, I think it was probably on NPR yesterday, about marketing baby carrots for kids in high school and how they're changing the marketing. And kind of they have this, it's an experiment, and it's super wild and wacky and almost violent. And and it made me think about you and what your challenges are to get out the vote and get people interested in voting, and how do you do it differently now than you ever have, or how do you think about when you're sitting around talking about what do we do to get people excited and get people caring about voting? What do you talk about?
Well, you know, we talk about going where people are, which is why we do have a website, since that's where folks are going to get their information, especially young folks. And we've been, we share everyone's concerns about the very low turnout for younger folks. And I know here in Ohio, particularly here in the Cleveland area, they are doing a mock this is not the first election cycle that the Cleveland area leagues have been working with high schools on mock elections.
Mm-hmm.
And this year it sounds like this will be particularly significant for the participating high schools, because they're going to get to hear from and, you know, in their mock elections do a simulated vote for their county counselors that are running in districts, because I understand that the league has been very instrumental in a new county government structure. So that sounds like it should be very, very exciting and a great reason for people to get out and vote.
Are there some states that are better than others at doing this?
You know, that's really hard to say. We've got leagues in all 50 states, mm-hmm. and we work diligently and tirelessly in these elections to get out candidate information, to do forums, to get folks register voters, get voters out. And whether one state does a better job than the other is impossible to say. This is an enormously important election, not just because we are electing Congress, all the Congress, and mm-hmm.
Governors.
But it's also because of governors and because we're voting on state legislators who are going to decide what our next districts are going to look like. This has been a mm-hmm. census year, and the next step in all of this that citizens really need to be watching is what happens in the state houses with respect to redistricting.
And in Ohio, that's the governor, the auditor, secretary of state, and then reps from both houses.
Right. Yeah, and I believe your legislature decides on congressional districts.
Right.
And the public is probably not as aware as it needs to be. Everybody is talking about civil discourse. Well, one of the first things that can happen is that we can start paying attention to how these districts are drawn, so that there are they are compact, they are competitive, they involve communities of interest other than communities of political interest.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to speak with Elizabeth McNamara. And Rod, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to express my support for full disclosure campaign contributions. I know that let me mention a couple groups basically a couple of individuals. Carl Rove has been involved with Crossroads America, and they've been contributing quite a bit, I guess, to campaigns. And the Koch brothers of Koch Industries have been contributing quite a bit to campaigns, especially Tea Party candidates. One thing I'd wanted to, since you mentioned elections, senatorial election is important, too, since... I've lost my train of thought here a minute.
Well, it's an open seat for the first time in a long time in Ohio. George Voinovich is retiring.
Yeah.
And
yes.
It's up.
I just picked it up again. Basically, mm-hmm. The Senate approves who goes to the Supreme Court, and as you said, the Supreme Court throughout 100 years of election reform. I'd like to mention too that. Basically, unions are democratically elected individuals. The president of the union, the membership votes for them, whereas the corporations, the CEOs, are chosen by a board of directors.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rod, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Thanks for listening. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Elizabeth, when you travel around the country, what are some of those obstacles that still concern you, besides the campaign finance laws, as far as getting people, are most people able to get to the ballot box?
We have been focusing with the league for a number of years on some of the obstacles that are making it more difficult for folks to register and for folks to vote. We have been very active in opposing ID requirements at the polls, specifically very restrictive photo ID requirements at the polls. We believe firmly that once you're registered, if that registration is valid, and I think generally we do a fairly decent job of weeding out registrations that shouldn't be there, most of which are innocent, then you should be able to go to the polls without having to produce any additional documentation. We have seen seen a rise of proof of citizenship requirements. I'm personally from Georgia, and that has become an issue in my state of newly naturalized citizens having to prove their citizenship over and over again in order to be able to exercise their most fundamental rights. On a more basic level, just things like recruiting and training poll workers can be that's the front line when, in a major election when folks are turning up to vote, and the better training that those poll workers have, the better people are going to be able to exercise their rights. Those folks deserve to have all the right answers. And so we've kind of been working on both ends to make sure that voters have what they need and that, we start emphasizing the entire system from administration of a statewide voter database to improve, to managing polling places, to making sure that there are enough poll workers and that those poll workers have the training that they need to make this a smooth experience for voters.
614-292-8513. We're running out of time, but Jim, we squeezed you in. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. The question has to do with the Disclosure Act. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that the ACLU is against what was proposed in the Senate, and my understanding is that the bill passed in the House of Representatives excluded the AARP as well as the NRA for disclosing what they want to do. And it seems to me like if it's good for one, it's good for the other. And I just wondered what you could shed some light on that particular aspect of it.
Thank you, Jim.
That's a great question, and I'm glad that you raised that. There is not an exemption from disclose for large nonprofits that fit the description of AARP, the Sierra Club, and the NRA. And I believe Planned Parenthood falls into that as well. What there is a partial exemption. There would be donors below a certain level would not have to, an entire donor list would not have to be disclosed, but major donors would still have to be disclosed, even for those organizations. And the ACLU has decided on that basis, as I understand it, not to support the legislation. The League of Women Voters, however, we feel that although we would prefer full disclosure for all special interests, nevertheless, this is not a full exemption, and that it is important to get this legislation passed so that voters have some idea of who it is that is speaking and how to judge their credibility.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. Elizabeth, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Elizabeth McNamara, she's national president of the League of Women Voters. She will be at the WOSU Media Center on, tomorrow for the taping of the Supreme Court candidates debate.
I'm looking forward to it.
Great. That's all the time we have. This is WOSU. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.